Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, Mesa's outgoing Mayor John Giles on development in his city and the response to his endorsement of Democrats.
And rethinking how we use a controversial word.
But first, it is a new year. There's a new slate of leaders taking office here in Maricopa County, and one of their first moves is already raising some eyebrows. Former Congresswoman Debbie Lesko didn't run for re-election to her seat in Washington last year. Instead, she ran for and won a seat on the County Board of Supervisors, and upon being sworn in yesterday, she announced she wants a new audit of county elections. It's a flashback to controversial audits of years past, even though new board chair Thomas Galvin promised it wouldn't be a repeat of the discredited audit completed by cyber ninjas after the 2020 election. Sasha Hupka has been covering it for the Arizona Republic, and she's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning there, Sasha.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So tell us more about this proposal for a new audit of county elections. Why do the Republicans on the board at least want to do it?
Well, their argument is essentially that this is just a check to make sure that everything's going well, there's nothing that can be improved upon. You know, is there any way that we can do our elections better? But I think what's notable here is that, one, I think this really marks a shift in the board and in its attitude toward election administration, which is something that we've seen them generally have a really unified front on in recent years. And two, they've already done several reviews of this nature. So I think what's kind of left to see is what is the actual full scope of this review, because those details weren't clear yesterday, even though they promised that this wasn't going to be a cyber ninjas-esque audit.
Right. So more to learn on how this will actually look. But talk more about that. You talked about this in your reporting, that this marks a definitive shift in what the county leaders have said and done about election administration. Like, this comes after years of former Board of Supes leaders, you know, staunchly defending elections in Maricopa County, sometimes to the extent that they were facing death threats, harassment.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that past supervisors have spent years really rejecting. And it's a topic that pushed some of them into a national limelight.
Yeah.
I think that what you really need to look at here is those three of the five seats on the board that changed hands. That's the most that have changed hands since the 1990s. And two of those new supervisors, Mark Stewart and Debbie Lesko, they campaigned on platforms that included election integrity. They're both Republicans. We saw that red wave that really was a theme nationally continued down ballot. So Republicans took all three of these seats. And I think that they are definitely going to be interesting voices to have on this board that historically has had this unified stance, particularly because, you know, this is a young board that's currently trying to figure out how are they actually going to work together and what is their, you know, era, so to speak, going to look like. Yesterday was the first test of that.
Right. So this is a largely new board. There's just one Democrat left on it. The two new members that you mentioned, are they election deniers? Like, what have they said about elections in Maricopa County?
So I think that, you know, to call somebody election denier, it kind of depends on, you know, how are you using that term, right? I think that Stewart maybe has not directly denied the results of past elections, but he has definitely criticized the board's handling of past elections. Lesko is in a little bit of a different boat. I think in her case, you maybe could call her a denier because she voted to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election when she was a congresswoman in the House of Representatives on January 6, 2021, almost 4 years ago today. So, you know, she is kind of in a slightly different category. And then that third newcomer, that's Republican Kate Brophy McGee. She has said that she was confident in the results of recent elections, but she's also kind of indicated that she's willing to consider proposed election policy reforms. And I think she's going to be a very crucial swing vote on that board. Galvin, you know, he and Democrat Steve Gallardo, who you also mentioned, they've kind of stood with the rest of the old board in terms of projecting this unified stance. Mm-hmm. And so they have a little bit more on the record as to exactly where they stand on some of these decisions.
Maricopa County also just elected a new recorder, Justin Heap, who's replacing Stephen Richer, who also kind of became famous for his staunch defense of elections here. Do you think it looks like we're going to see changes to elections in this county under these new leaders? Like, what else are they pushing for?
Yeah, I think that in terms of the actual proposed review, we don't know yet if that will include the recorder's office or not. But Heap is a very interesting figure, and he is someone who potentially could have a lot of power over elections. He has said repeatedly that he really would like to redo the election operations agreement between the recorder's office and the Board of Supervisors. And that's the agreement that divvies up what everybody is responsible for in terms of running elections. Heap has said he wants to redo that. The board actually just signed a new agreement with recorder Stephen Richer in October. He said it was short-sighted for them to do it so close to the end of their terms. And he now would like to redo it somehow. I think the question is, you know, can he get a majority of the board to actually do that? That's kind of still up in the air. Stewart and Lesko have indicated that they're willing. Kate Brophy McGee has kind of been a little bit more wishy-washy on that. And then Galvin and Gallardo have said that they, you know, are open to talking with him, but are not looking for changes here. And then I think the other question is, if he does manage to get a majority on board with that, you know, what do the changes he actually wants look like? I think he hasn't been really clear about exactly what powers he would seek to take back from the board. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that could make a really big difference in terms of how viable this is and what the impacts actually are.
All right. Lots to watch for. Sasha Hupka covering all of this for the Arizona Republic. Sasha, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
The state's third largest city will get a new mayor this evening. Former city councilman Mark Freeman will take the oath of office as mayor of Mesa. That will bring to an end the decade of John Giles' leadership of the city. He's overseen a good amount of growth and development in Mesa, both downtown and elsewhere around the city. He's also become more of a household name beyond the valley, thanks in large part to his endorsement of several high-profile Democratic political candidates, including Vice President Kamala Harris and now Governor Katie Hobbs. Giles is a Republican. John Giles stopped by the studio recently to talk about his time as Mesa's mayor and his involvement in state and national politics. And I started the conversation by asking the former city council member if, when he became mayor 10 years ago, he envisioned serving in that role for as long as he has.
You know, I remember just to remind everybody, I the first time I ran, it was just for 2 years because Scott Smith had resigned to run for governor, and so that created an opening. So I was elected in August of 2024 and immediately sworn in because we had a vacancy in the mayor. And people pointed out, hey, you could serve for 10 years. And I remember thinking, that's too long. Right. I mean, that's not what I had initially. I was a little surprised to hear that. I've been thinking, I don't know that that's what I that seems like too long for anybody to do anything.
OK.
But now looking backward on it, it's like, I mean, that was over before it started.
Was there a point at which 10 years didn't seem too long to you to be doing this?
Right now. Yeah. Looking back, you know, over my shoulder. Or even, you know, like 2 years ago, I kept thinking, man, that went fast, but I still got, man, 2 years is a long time. So I think a lot of people my age, you know, looking back, it seems like things have accelerated the older you get. And so that was my experience. It went by very, very fast.
I would imagine it would be interesting in your position to be able to sort of physically see some of the changes that have happened, like literally right outside your window at City Hall in Mesa over the 10 years that you've been doing this.
That's been really fun because there were, like you say, the ASU building, a lot of the improvements on Main Street, a lot of the new businesses that have come in into buildings that were dark. And then if you go out to the Gateway area, my gosh, every time I go there, I have to recheck, you know, to kind of reorient myself on the horizon, because there's, you know, these commercial buildings that are going up right and left. And that's true really citywide. So, yeah, it is fun to think back on what on some of the physical the places that have been created, you know, the parks and the libraries and the municipal buildings. We just cut the ribbon on a brand new city hall. So yeah, there has been that's been fun.
I know that this question is a bit like asking a parent to pick their favorite child, but is there something that has happened during your time in Mesa that you look to and maybe you are the most proud of, mm-hmm. or that you think is the biggest deal for the city?
You're right. It is picking a favorite child, but I have two or three favorite children. You know, it's been fun to see the Mesa College Promise come up to speed and become something that's sustainable. One of the needs that I could see early on is that Mesa we needed to be better at higher education attainment. I mean, Mesa is next to a college town in Tempe that has, you know, very high education levels, fairly affluent communities of Chandler and Gilbert and Queen Creek that, again, have very high education attainment levels. Mesa's twice the size of those cities, and we've had this amazing economic development success with, you know, Apple, Google, Meta, et cetera, coming. And so workforce has not been a problem, but still, I could tell that was something that we needed to get better at, raising our education attainment level. So the College Promise and Mesa, and the partnership with Mesa Community College seemed like the obvious tool. And so we're now entering our fourth year of that and just made some changes to our billboard ordinance to allow Mesa Community College to have the means going forward for that to be a sustainable program. So that, I think, will continue to have some significant impact on the lives of people in our community. The non-discrimination ordinance, similarly, was something that I thought was impactful and will continue to be in letting the people of all of the people of Mesa know that they're important, but also raising the image of our community.
When you talk about educational attainment, I'm curious about how you're seeing, for example, ASU's expanded presence in Mesa between the Polytechnic campus and, of course, the Mix Center downtown. Mm-hmm. I know you and ASU President Michael Crowe worked together quite a bit on that. What has that meant for Mesa?
Well, it has been very transformational. We have been making significant investments in our downtown since I was on our council back in the 90s with the creation of the Mesa Arts Center and then the investment in light rail. And now the investment in ASU and other programs and buildings downtown. But we really needed an anchor tenant. So that was did have the transformational impact that we were hoping for. And that's going to continue. The Mix Center is amazing and it's wonderful, but it's the first of several investments that ASU and the city will make.
I'm curious about what happens once you are done as mayor. Mark Freeman, a council member, will mm-hmm. be taking over. Have you guys had conversations about the direction he would like to take the city, how much of what you've sort of laid down he wants to continue versus maybe trying different things?
We have, absolutely. Mark and I have sat next to each other and worked together for the last 8 years as he's been on our council. So a lot of the things that I've been doing have been with in concert with then council member Freeman. So it's not going to be a tremendous change, I don't think. Mark will do it his way, and Mark's going to be a great mayor. I'm looking forward to seeing the energy that he brings to the job. Change is good.
That is outgoing Mesa Mayor John Giles. Our conversation continues in just a moment. You are listening to the show. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the D word has long been controversial, but one author says it doesn't have to be.
But first, let's return now to my conversation with Mesa's outgoing mayor, John Giles. His successor, former city council member Mark Freeman, will take the oath of office this evening.
Giles created some waves 2 years ago when he endorsed the Democrat, then Secretary of State Katie Hobbs, in her run for governor. Giles is a Republican. This past cycle, he endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris for president and Ruben Gallego for U.S. Senate. He spoke at last summer's Democratic National Convention in support of the former. So when he came by the studio recently, I asked about his role in state and national politics, and that while Mesa is the third biggest city in the state, the former mayors of Mesa have maybe not gotten as much national attention as he has. So I wondered what that's been like for him.
I think I've been pleased to do that because I am glad it has kind of raised the national profile of Mesa. My predecessor, Scott Smith, was he began that process. He was the president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and he kind of, I think, elevated Mesa's presence. And I joke sometimes that those of us who are native to Mesa are proud of our humility. And we're a little, you know, we're not necessarily at the front of the parade, perhaps as much as Mesa should be. Mesa, frankly, is recognized around the country now as being one of the more innovative cities in the country. And it's the 36th largest city in the country, bigger than a lot of household names. And I think now we have a reputation for being a city that does things right. You know, if we take on a challenge, we're going to do it in a way that probably cities from around the country are going to come and ask us how we were successful.
What kind of feedback have you gotten at home, both, I would imagine, positive and negative, about some of the candidates you've endorsed, mm-hmm. Specifically Democratic candidates, mm-hmm. and some of the positions that you've taken on other, you know, sort of statewide or national issues?
Well, you know, for the first 8 years I was mayor, I went through contortions to try to avoid getting drawn into partisan politics because I thought that would probably not, you know, help me in my role as mayor. And a couple of years ago, I felt compelled to do just as you described, to actually endorse some folks from the other party. And I did get blowback and condemnation from members of my party. And then even more so this year when I endorsed the vice president. I kind of expected that and was not shocked by the negative comments from across the country that came in. But I was, frankly, a little taken back by the positive reaction I got. During that time and even today, if I'm in a public place at the grocery store or out, you know, at a city event, inevitably several people will stop me and thank me for giving voice to a sentiment that they share and that they are glad was being expressed.
What were those decisions like for you before you initially, let's say, decided to endorse then-candidate Katie Hobbs, mm-hmm. and you endorsed Mark Kelly, of course, as you referenced. This year you endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris, you endorsed Ruben Gallego.
Yeah.
Like, what were those conversations like with advisors and friends and family? Mm-hmm. What were the conversations mm-hmm. like just with yourself? You're a Republican. Mm-hmm. Here you are going against your party in a very polarized time.
Yeah, you know, I didn't do it lightly, frankly. It was pretty deliberate. And going back 2 years, I jumped into those races because I knew that the candidates from my party, were they elected, it would not be in the best interest of my city. They were already aligned with kind of Freedom Caucus folks in the legislature who had a very anti-city agenda. And I could see that and at that time— You know, Katie Hobbs was projected to lose big in that election. And so I didn't do it in some sort of strategic, you know, I'll get in good with the governor type of a motivation. It's just I knew that the candidates on my side were going to pursue an agenda that was not in the best interest of my city. So I felt compelled to do it as the mayor. I didn't do it in spite of being the Republican mayor. I did it because I was the Republican mayor and I could see the consequences were not going to be in the best interest of my city.
Was that the thinking in 2024 as well?
It was. Yeah, and Mr. Trump won the election, and congratulations. And in all sincerity, I'm hoping that he is successful because that will our country needs him to be successful. So I'm not crying over that, but I did, and I continue to feel like, given his prior performance, that I had serious concerns that his presidency was going to be in the best interest of our city.
So if you're hanging out with friends. Like, mm-hmm. are you welcome among conservative yeah. Republican friends still? Like, are you, yeah. do you just like walk around with a sign that says Rhino on your back at all times now? Like, how does that go?
You know, it's been interesting. And Mayor Corey Woods from Tempe and I started a few months ago something called Disagree Better Arizona yeah. For just that scenario. You know, this fact that we have in our personal relationships and in our families, you know, a lot of people with mixed views on politics, and this has become such a divisive topic where, you know, you've relationships, family relationships, long-term school buddies, you know, are now, you know, hating each other. And it's we need to get better at saying, yeah, let's talk about politics, but let's not let that be the defining thing that decides who we love and who we can hang out with.
Have you found it's maybe a little different for someone like you where, yes, you can maybe go into somebody's living room and disagree with them, or, you know, you see them at the grocery store. You were speaking at the Democratic National Convention. You were in commercials
yeah.
for Democratic candidates. Does
yeah.
that make it any different?
Oh, yes, it did. I mean, I became a lightning rod, and this kind of irrational hatred that I mentioned earlier, kind of I've seen that manifest, certainly. And I hope people get over that. I mean, I have friends and family who are conservative, you know, Trump supporters, and that's okay with me. You know, I don't disrespect them. I think they're smart, and we just disagreed over a few things. And I hopefully, as the you know, we put more distance between the election and going forward, those sentiments will come down.
We've heard in the past from some elected officials in Arizona about, you know, sort of the stuff they went through in terms of death threats and in terms of losing friends and, mm-hmm. and you know, family members as people that they can be with and, you know, detailing basically being diagnosed, one at least diagnosed with PTSD.
Yeah.
Have you had any of that?
I have had threats, sure. And the police department, you know, became a bigger part of my life than it was before the campaign. And that continues even to this last weekend, you know, just looking at some social media posts. But that's just the world we live in now. And so, unfortunately, you have to have tough skin. And if you're going to do things like this, you just have to understand that's part of what happens.
Has any of that made you, I don't want to use the word regret, because I know mm-hmm. that's a very heavy, loaded term, but has any of it made you maybe rethink how you've handled politics over the last couple of years?
No, because I think if you allow yourself to be intimidated by that, you're not going to do a good job. You know, that this job, jobs like this require a certain amount of courage, I guess, it seems weird to claim that, but people who do these jobs, if you're going to have your tail between your legs, you probably ought to find something different to do.
So what's next for you?
You know, I hope to, I'm professionally an attorney. I practiced law for 25 years prior to coming to this, and I found that a rewarding career, and I very likely will pick that back up again. But I have really enjoyed, frankly, the last 10 years not practicing law and being working on issues that I'm passionate about and compelling good causes. So I will find ways to remain engaged in compelling good causes, I think, and maybe as an attorney or maybe in some other capacity, but not necessarily pursuing elected office.
All right. That is John Giles, the outgoing mayor of the city of Mesa. Mayor Giles, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. The Oakland Zoo in California is relocating its last remaining African elephant, Osh, to the Elephant Sanctuary in Tennessee later this year. And it's just the latest zoo to do it. In the last few decades, dozens of zoos have closed their elephant exhibits, a movement that's been cheered by animal activists who say there's growing recognition that intelligent and social animals like elephants don't belong in zoos. The Phoenix Zoo has one elephant in its exhibit, Indu, and we'll hear more about her future in the next few minutes. But first, let's turn to one of those activists. Mickey Pardo is an elephant biologist and behavior ecologist who has studied both Asian elephants and African elephants in the wild. His groundbreaking research found that every elephant likely has its own name. I spoke with him more about his work and why he thinks more zoos should move their elephants out.
I grew up going to the zoo all the time and I loved it. And the reason why I loved it is because I loved wild animals. You know, I loved being able to see them. And so, you know, any kind of opportunity to interact with them in any way was something that I really enjoyed. But as I started learning more, especially, you know, as I started getting involved in studying wild animals professionally, I started learning and realizing that there simply is no way for certain animals, including elephants, to be kept in a zoo in a way that provides them with a good quality of life. Hmm. And it's not, that's not to say that the zoos don't, or the zookeepers don't care about the elephants that they're caring for and want them to have a good life. It's just not something that's within their power to provide, given the inherent limitations on a zoo environment.
Huh. So let me ask you about your own work and its role mm-hmm. in this, because you've done some pretty groundbreaking work on elephants in the wild and how basically you discovered that it seems like they each have individual names that they call each other. Talk a little bit about how elephants live in the wild, how intelligent and emotionally intelligent they seem to be.
Yeah. So for all species of elephants, they have a large number of social relationships, and they have different social relationships with different individuals. And they all have this, what we call fission-fusion dynamics in their society. So they come together and then split apart and then come back together and split apart, depending on the environmental conditions and just on what they want to do in a particular moment. So they're often out of sight of their social companions. And that was kind of the impetus for why I thought that they might have something like a name and why I started that study, because it seems that given their social structure, it would be particularly beneficial for them to be able to address communication to a specific individual when they're out of sight of each other. But their social relationships really form the basis of their life in the wild. And that's a big part of the reason why we think that they've evolved such large brains and exceptional cognitive abilities. So for example, they have the ability to keep maybe up 30 or more pieces of information in their working memory at once, which is remarkable because for humans, the average is 7.
Smarter than us in some ways. Wow.
Yeah, in that way specifically.
Yeah. Yeah. So an elephant living in a zoo, right? And especially an elephant living in a zoo alone, which happens in some places. That's the case at the Phoenix Zoo right now. What are they not getting that you think they need that they would get in the wild?
Well, when you think about elephants who are housed alone specifically, it's very closely analogous to humans who are held in solitary confinement, right? This is something we have in common with elephants, that we're both highly social species. And when we don't have the opportunity for normal social behavior, it has a profoundly negative psychological impact on us. So one thing that we see in zoo elephants, and this is true of elephants regardless of whether they're held alone or in small social groups in zoos, they tend to exhibit stereotypical behaviors, repetitive movements that don't really serve any adaptive purpose. And they result from when an individual's brain is basically bombarded with excessively high levels of stress hormones, glucocorticoids. We see this in humans who are held in solitary confinement in prisons. We also see it. One study found that 80% of the elephants that they observed across, they looked at dozens of zoos and they found 80% of the elephants that they observed exhibited stereotypical behaviors.
So you have advocated for zoos to release their elephants. What are the other options? Like they can't go back in the wild. They're given to sanctuaries instead, right?
Right. So in most cases, it wouldn't be logistically feasible to return elephants to the wild. So the other option is to send elephants to sanctuaries.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, sanctuaries are still a form of captivity. But one major difference between sanctuaries and zoos is the amount of space, right? So the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, I believe that their minimum requirement for elephants is 0.12 acres per individual.
Mm-hmm.
In most zoos in North America, the total size of the elephant exhibit is less than 2 acres, maybe 2 acres at most. There are a couple that are more than that. Now, in sanctuaries, it's going to be a lot less than what some elephants experience in the wild. But for example, there's an elephant sanctuary in Tennessee, and they have something like 3,000 acres on their property, right? So that's actually the size of the smaller end of wild natural home ranges in elephants. And having a larger habitat gives elephants the opportunity to walk more, which gives them exercise, helps reduce some of the physical ailments that they suffer from in zoos. And it also provides them with a much more varied environment. So they have the opportunity to forage more naturally, to split apart from each other rather than constantly being in each other's presence as they're forced to be in zoos. And it allows for larger group sizes. So elephants can have a slightly more natural social environment.
I want to ask you about the underlying issue here that you're getting at, right? Like this you frame as an issue of liberty, right? Like you talk in your piece about how courts are granting legal rights to other non-human entities like rivers or forests or corporations, but that is not the case for animals. You think maybe they should have that kind of level, it sounds like, of liberty under the law and respect.
Absolutely. So I think this applies to many other animal species, not just elephants. So the issue for me here is, how do we decide who gets rights, right? Like historically, rights have unfortunately been limited to a small subset of the human population, right? Like in the United States for a long time, women didn't have the right to vote. Non-white people didn't have the right to vote. And it took courts quite a while to decide that yes, Black people are people under the law. Women are people under the law. Native Americans are people under the law. That we didn't used to, you know, this country and many other countries didn't used to expand the definition of person even to all humans. So why do we think that all humans deserve rights? And I think that really what it boils down to is the ability to have feelings, right? When somebody has feelings, they're sentient. They can suffer, they can feel joy. To me, that's the point at which that individual needs to have certain legal rights. And I think that applies to many non-human animals as well. Wow. And I think the evidence is abundant that many animals are far more intelligent and emotionally complex than we've ever realized. And I think with that growing scientific understanding, our society needs to evolve to the point where we include these individuals within our moral circle and recognize that they should all have the same basic legal protections for life and liberty and that kind of thing.
That's fascinating. Let me ask you lastly, Mickey, about the broader context here, specifically when it comes to zoos and elephants, right? Like we are seeing more zoos around the country and around the world release their elephants. Do you think that this is going to be the wave of the future, at least when it comes to this really intelligent and really beloved species?
Yeah, I think so, or at least I hope so. I think we've seen, unfortunately, a lot of resistance from zoos to doing this. For some zoos, at least, I'm sure that it boils down to money, that they bring in revenue from having these elephants, and they don't want to lose that. But I'm just speculating here. I don't really know why there's been so much resistance. I just know that there has been a great deal of resistance. But I do hope that this is the way of the future, that at some point we will see zoos evolve into institutions that focus on providing education in a way that doesn't cause animals extreme suffering.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Mickey Pardo, behavioral ecologist and elephant biologist, joining us to talk about this. Mickey, thank you very much for your views here. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So what about that one elephant here at the Phoenix Zoo? Well, I found out the folks there have talked about moving her to the elephant sanctuary, but it's not quite that simple for her. Here is my conversation with Dr. Gary West, Senior Vice President of Animal Health and Living Collections at the Phoenix Zoo.
Well, Indu is a 59-year-old Asian elephant. She's been at the Phoenix Zoo about 20 years. She's quirky in a good way. She has certain people she really, really loves. She has a greater one-horned rhinoceros, Chudi, that you've probably seen at the zoo, who she also really loves. Historically, she's not been a big fan of other elephants. You know, prior to coming here, she was not a big fan of being with other elephants at the Houston Zoo. And then they were hoping when she came here, and it was prior to my time, there was hope she would integrate with two retired circus elephants. And then there was also an elephant here that was sort of famous for painting named Ruby at the time.
Yeah.
And she wasn't a big, big fan. And she was even to the point where she was aggressive toward the other elephants. And so she really prefers not not to be with other elephants. She really adores some of her keepers, really looks forward to seeing some of them. I would say she's a lovely old lady, very loved by her keepers and the veterinary staff here at the Phoenix Zoo.
So you explained there a little bit about why she is alone in the exhibit. Let me ask you a little bit about some of the broader context we're having this conversation in. Right now, we're seeing a lot of zoos, dozens around the country, close their elephant exhibits because of concerns that they're not good for the elephants, that they can't kind of live full lives. They tend to die prematurely. They need to be in more social environments. What do you make of those arguments and sort of the broader conversation that's happening about elephants in zoos right now?
You know, we've had those discussions internally. I think, you know, Association of Zoos and Aquarium accredited zoos like Phoenix Zoo, we're always looking for all of our animals to strive for optimum welfare. And so what is that for an elephant? Well, there's certainly social aspects and there's management aspects. And I think zoos, you know, once they're starting to get down to maybe one or two elephants and they're looking at, you know, should we phase elephants out for the future? I would say on the flip side, there's some zoos that have made huge investments into elephant exhibits and elephant management and the social needs of elephants. So, you know, not all zoos are doing that, but for some zoos, it's the right way to go, is to say, hey, we're probably not meeting optimum welfare for this elephant or our last couple of elephants. And so, you know, the elephant sanctuary in Tennessee may be a good option to send these animals.
Yeah, and we're seeing zoos decide to do that, as you say. Talk a little bit about the care of an elephant like Indu and what kind of connection she can have with her human caregivers as opposed to having sort of a social environment with other elephants.
We have five keepers and an elephant manager basically take care of three animals in that area right now. So she has a lot of social interaction with keepers. She gets a lot of individualized care. She gets a lot of specialized care, behavioral enrichment. You know, she's a 59-year-old elephant, so she's, you know, got stiff joints and some other medical issues. And so she gets things like laser therapy on her joints. She gets hydrotherapy on her joints. You know, I this is probably a bold statement. I've worked with elephants for about 25 years in captivity, and I would say she gets the most individualized, specialized care that I've ever seen an elephant get.
That's really interesting. Do you think, Gary, that an elephant like this can live a kind of full life in the same way as she might in the wild or in a sanctuary setting, in a zoo setting, even though, you know, she can't be around other elephants, it seems like? Do those human interactions, does that level of care make up for it?
I think it does. Again, you know, it's my personal opinion and it's subjective. And of course, we all love elephants and we all want elephants to socialize with other elephants. And those attempts have been made with her. She has chosen that's not something she's interested in. And so we have discussed, you know, I think that the sanctuary option, the elephant sanctuary in Tennessee, is a great facility. I know the chief operating officer personally. I've known him for 30 years. And I think it's a great facility. So we've talked about that. Our hesitancy is with her age and her underlying health issues. Mm-hmm. I don't know that would be a good option for her as far as a long trip. It's not a simple thing. It's not a simple logistic thing to move an elephant that far. And some elephants, unfortunately, have made that long trek and then have passed away shortly after arrival there. So those sorts of things also weigh in our mind of sending her so far. And then will she really want to socialize or interact? Are you taking away from the people and other things that she's used to and loves? So, you know, again, it's opinions and it can be a bit subjective, but we also look at welfare through objective assessments. And so we do that on a regular basis. You know, does she seem to interact? Does she seem to move around? Does she seem, you know, happy and satisfied? Are we providing optimal welfare for her? And we feel like we are.
Mm. So what are the plans for the elephant exhibit at the zoo once Indu does pass? Because this is, as you say, she's old.
Yeah, so currently we have Chudy. I mentioned her buddy next door is a greater one-horned rhinoceros, and then we are acquiring two more young male greater one-horned rhinoceros. So we are not planning to exhibit more Asian elephants in that current space. We are going to be converting that to greater one-horned rhinoceros, which lives solitarily, and they are going to be occupying those exhibits.
So you will discontinue the elephant exhibit at the Phoenix Zoo at some point there?
The current one, yes. You know, we haven't had a lot of internal discussions about what the future holds, but, you know, we've had some high level discussions if we got back into elephants down the road. You know, African elephants probably would be a better fit for the desert and for our climate, but it would take a huge investment and we'd have to look at space and where that would be at the zoo or on the property of the zoo. So that's just been sort of a pie in the sky discussion, but there really isn't any plans for elephants right now.
All right, we'll leave it there. Dr. Gary West, the Senior Vice President of Animal Health and Living Collections at the Phoenix Zoo, joining us. Dr. West, thank you for coming on. Thank you so much for your perspective here. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. An Arizona writer wants to change the way we think about a controversial word. Here's the show's Sam Dingman with more.
All right. So in just a moment, I'm going to have a conversation about a word. The word starts with a D and it rhymes with strike. And it's a word that has often been used as an insult directed at queer women. But for writer Molly McCloy, it is a word that she, like many other queer women, proudly self-applies. She, in fact, recently referred to it as her favorite reclaimed slur on her Substack. And Molly has been thinking about this word a lot because it's in the title of a memoir that she's writing. It's going to come out next year. And as she writes in her Substack post about this, her friends love the title of the book, but she's curious to see how the generally straight public is going to respond to having that word on her book cover. As recently, she writes, as 2017, Facebook prohibited lesbian Facebookers from using that word as a self-referential term. TikTok currently blocks her from using it in video captions. There's a group of activists whose name includes this word. And their ability to use this word was challenged, and the litigation actually went all the way to the Supreme Court. So it's a very loaded word. And you'll notice that I am not saying the word in this intro, and that is because that is how Molly and I began our conversation. I didn't want to assume that she would be comfortable with a straight male radio host using the word. But pretty much as soon as we started talking, things took a surprising turn. And that's because, for Molly, what matters isn't whether or not someone says the word. It's how they say it.
What I think is actually more important is that straight people listen to the way that we want to say the word. So I actually thought maybe we could try it out a little bit. I've got a couple of statements that you can read out loud if you would like to try it. One is just the title of my book.
Okay. All right. Well, let me say the title of the book right from the beginning. It's Nine Grudges, The Spiteful Origins of the Happiest Dyke on Earth.
Wait, how did that feel for you? Just out of curiosity.
Well, there's kind of no way for me to just not share my own backstory with this, which is that I was in a long-term relationship for many, many years with someone who ultimately decided that their sexuality was such that it was no longer appropriate for them to be in a relationship with me. Mm-hmm. And so we parted ways, and that was the best choice for both of us. But in the context of them going on that journey, a big part of their story was claiming this word and feeling like it really felt like home for them to say it.
Oh, so you have personal experience with somebody that's embraced this word.
I do, but that's the first time I've ever said it out loud.
Oh, interesting.
Not because I'm afraid of it, but because I'm afraid of how it will sound coming out of my mouth.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And that's why I've kind of queued you up for the next statement, because, you know, there's a big difference in the way your culture uses the word versus how my culture uses the word. You want to try the top one there?
I will. Okay. Dykes are happy, audacious rebels who should be admired for their bravery, not be maligned or pitied.
How did that one feel?
Well, I can't escape the context of, you know, I think of my former partner as an audacious rebel.
Oh, good.
who was very brave. But I also am aware that straight people have often used this word to malign. Or, and the pity context, I wasn't aware of, but I'd be interested to hear more about that.
Well, it's because I'm embracing the word as a positive term, because we are not necessarily considered in society to, we're considered to be sort of a dour, angry, and unfashionable would be sort of the bad rap that we get. And that, you know, there's that old idea that, you know, lesbians can't get a man. And so there's where the pity comes in. And the truth is, we're one of the happiest segments of society. And I think a big part of the problem is letting us say dyke that way.
Yeah. I'd actually be really interested to know what feels good to you about using that word that pushes back against this perception that you were describing.
Okay. You know, that word is generally used as sort of a sort of policing people. If a woman stands up to a man, you know, if a girl stands up to a boy, a teenage girl, that's what you get called, you know. And so by high school, I'm curling my hair and I'm dating guys and fell in love with a woman when I was 18. And then I have the moment that I put in the article, which is, you know, I'm at the queer meeting at the Evergreen State College, and this beautiful punk rock woman comes in with her blue Doc Martens, and she says, "Yeah, you know, this man just called me a dyke, and I've been having some good experiences with hot dykes lately, so I just told him, say that again." And I thought, that's it.
It's really standing in it in a way that is about love and inclusion and being seen. It's not against anybody. And doing that has the potential to flummox people who think they can use it as a term of hate.
I think that was really well said. I think you're really getting at it here.
I was very nervous the whole time.
No, I think you've got it. It's about love and love of women, and which surprises people, because there are certain men that always think that lesbianism is a reaction to men, which is funny to us because it's about women.
Right. But in your own life and in your study of this term, is there controversy about the idea that this term was originally used as a way of attacking people?
Absolutely. And it's gone in and out of fashion for a long time. There are queer women that don't like it, don't want to take it on. And I respect that decision, because within that group of people, there are people that just don't like labels at all. And there are also people with extremely painful, traumatic histories where that word has been used against them.
Of course.
And of course, they don't want to engage that pain. So I can understand those things.
What is the term mean to you as distinct from, say, lesbian or queer or gay? Like, is there something about this word in particular that feels like it fits in a way that those words don't?
For me, I used to be frustrated when I was trying to figure out what to call myself when I was in my 20s. I was sort of frustrated that gay men still got to be men. And I thought, but I have to become a lesbian, and makes me sound like I'm not a woman anymore, you know?
Right.
When I saw other women taking on dyke as a point of pride, I thought, that's a lot more exciting to me than lesbian or anything else. It got at the rebellion of it and sort of the defiance of it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I had a professor tell me in college, I was bristling at the word lesbian at the point. And he said, well, I love it. I love this idea of this island of women. And I thought, I bet you do. You know? And I like dyke better, because it's a little bit more empowering. And it just struck me as the right stance to just take something that I'm supposed to be scared of and embrace it.
We've been talking about loaded words. And nine grudges, the spiteful origins of the happiest dyke on earth. So what does happiness look like for you? Because it's kind of a bold thing to self-apply, no matter who you are. The idea of saying, I'm a happy person.
Yeah, that's a great question. I talk a little bit towards the end of the book that it's been difficult for me to claim happiness. I mean, we're talking some physical and verbal abuse from my dad in the book. You know, we're talking about like overcoming some of these things. And so happiness has actually been difficult for me to claim. And I'll say that what happiness to me has been 20 great years with my wife, Rebecca, and just being content, living each day with gratitude and appreciation for what I have.
Well, amen to that. Molly, thank you for this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Molly McCloy's book, Nine Grudges, The Spiteful Origins of the Happiest Dyke on Earth, will be out next year. In the meantime, you can find her on Substack at mollymccloy.substack.com.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.